Behind the Scenes by Elizabeth Keckley. Chapter 6. Willie Lincoln's Deathbed. Mrs. Lincoln returned to Washington in November, and again duty called me to the White House. The war was now in progress, and every day brought stirring news from the front where the gray opposed the blue, where flashed the bright saber in the sunshine, where we heard the angry notes of battle, the deep roar of cannon, and the fearful rattle of musketry, where new graves were being made every day, where brother forgot a mother's early blessing and sought the lifeblood of brother, and friend raised the deadly knife against friend. Oh, the front, with its stirring battle scenes. Oh, the front, with its ghastly heaps of dead. The life of the nation was at stake, and when the land was full of sorrow, there could not be much gaiety at the Capitol. The days passed quietly with me. I soon learned that some people had an intense desire to penetrate the inner circle of the White House. No president and his family, heretofore occupying this mansion, ever excited so much curiosity as the present incumbents. Mr. Lincoln had grown up in the wilds of the West, and evil report had said much of him and his wife. The polite world was shocked, and the tendency to exaggerate intensified curiosity. As soon as it was known that I was the modiste of Mrs. Lincoln, parties crowded around and affected friendship for me, hoping to induce me to betray the secrets of the domestic circle. One day a woman, I will not call her a lady, drove up to my rooms, gave me an order to make a dress, and insisted on partly paying me in advance. She called on me every day and was exceedingly kind. When she came to take her dress away, she cautiously remarked, "Mrs. Keckley, you know Mrs. Lincoln?"
"Yes."
"You are her modiste, are you not?"
"Yes."
"You know her very well, do you not?"
"I am with her every day or two."
"Don't you think you would have some influence with her?"
"I cannot say. Mrs. Lincoln, I presume, would listen to anything I should suggest, but whether she would be influenced by a suggestion of mine is another question."
"I am sure that you could influence her, Mrs. Keckley." "Now listen, I have a proposition to make. I have a great desire to become an inmate of the White House. I have heard so much of Mr. Lincoln's goodness that I should like to be near him, and if I can enter the White House no other way, I am willing to go as a menial. My dear Mrs. Keckley, will you not recommend me to Mrs. Lincoln as a friend of yours out of employment, and ask her to take me as a chambermaid? If you will do this, you shall be well rewarded. It may be worth several thousand dollars to you in time." I looked at the woman in amazement. A bribe? And to betray the confidence of my employer? Turning to her with a glance of scorn, I said, "Madam, you are mistaken in regard to my character. Sooner than betray the trust of a friend, I would throw myself into the Potomac River. I am not so base as that. Pardon me, but there's the door, and I trust that you will never enter my room again." She sprang to her feet in deep confusion and passed through the door, murmuring, "Very well, you will live to regret your action today." "Never, never," I exclaimed, and closed the door after her with a bang. I afterwards learned that this woman was an actress, and that her object was to enter the White House as a servant, learn its secrets, and then publish a scandal to the world. I do not give her name, for such publicity would wound the sensitive feelings of friends, who would have to share her disgrace without being responsible for her faults. I simply record the incident to show how I often was approached by unprincipled parties. It is unnecessary to say that I indignantly refused every bribe offered. The first public appearance of Mrs. Lincoln that winter was at the reception of New Year's Day. This reception was shortly followed by a brilliant levee.
The day after the levee, I went to the White House, and while fitting a dress to Mrs. Lincoln, she said, "Elizabeth," she had learned to drop the E, "Elizabeth, I have an idea. These are war times, and we must be as economical as possible. You know the president is expected to give a series of state dinners every winter, and these dinners are very costly. Now, I want to avoid this expense, and my idea is that if I give 3 large receptions, the state dinners can be scratched from the program. What do you think, Elizabeth?"
"I think that you are right, Mrs. Lincoln."
"I am glad to hear you say so. If I can make Mr. Lincoln take the same view of the case, I shall not fail to put the idea into practice." Before I left her room that day, Mr. Lincoln came in. She at once stated the case to him. He pondered the question a few moments before answering, "Mother, I'm afraid your plan will not work."
"But it will work if you will only determine that it shall work."
"It is breaking in on the regular custom," he mildly replied.
"But you forget, Father, these are war times, and old customs can be done away with for the once."
"The idea is economical, you must admit."
"Yes, Mother, but we must think of something besides economy."
"I do think of something else. Public receptions are more democratic than stupid state dinners, are more in keeping with the spirit of the institutions of our country, as you would say if called upon to make a stump speech. There are a great many strangers in the city, foreigners and others, whom we can entertain at our receptions, but whom we cannot invite to our dinners."
"I believe you are right, Mother. You argue the point well. I think that we shall have to decide on the receptions."
So the day was carried. The question was decided, and arrangements were made for the first reception. It was now January, and cards were issued for February. The children, Tad and Willie, were constantly receiving presents. Willie was so delighted with a little pony that he insisted on riding it every day. The weather was changeable, and exposure resulted in a severe cold, which deepened into fever. He was very sick, and I was summoned to his bedside. It was sad to see the poor boy suffer. Always of a delicate constitution, he could not resist the strong inroads of disease. The days dragged wearily by, and he grew weaker and more shadow-like. He was his mother's favorite child, and she doted on him. It grieved her heart sorely to see him suffer. When able to be about, he was almost constantly by her side. When I would go in her room, almost always I found blue-eyed Willie there, reading from an open book or curled up in a chair with pencil and paper in hand. He had decidedly a literary taste and was a studious boy. A short time before his death, he wrote this simple little poem. Washington, D.C., October 30th, 1861. "Dear Sir, I enclose you my first attempt at poetry. Yours truly, William W. Lincoln." To the editor of the National Republican, "Lines on the Death of Colonel Edward Baker." There was no patriot like Baker, so noble and so true. He fell as a soldier on the field, his face to the sky of blue. His voice is silent in the hall which oft his presence graced. No more he'll hear the loud acclaim which rang from place to place. No squeamish notions filled his breast. The Union was his theme. No surrender and no compromise, his day, thought, and night's dream. His country was her part to pay towards those he has left behind. His widow and his children all she must always keep in mind. Finding that Willie continued to grow worse, Mrs. Lincoln determined to withdraw her cards of invitation and postpone the reception. Mr. Lincoln thought that the cards had better not be withdrawn. At least he advised that the doctor be consulted before any steps were taken. Accordingly, Dr. Stone was called in. He pronounced Willie better, and said that there was every reason for an early recovery. He thought, since the invitations had been issued, it would be best to go on with the reception. Willie, he insisted, was in no immediate danger. Mrs. Lincoln was guided by these counsels, and no postponement was announced. On the evening of the reception, Willie was suddenly taken worse. His mother sat by his bedside a long while, holding his feverish hand in her own and watching his labored breathing. The doctor claimed there was no cause for alarm. I arranged Mrs. Lincoln's hair, then assisted her to dress. Her dress was white satin, trimmed with black lace. The trail was very long, and as she swept through the room, Mr. Lincoln was standing with his back to the fire, his hands behind him, and his eyes on the carpet. His face wore a thoughtful, solemn look. The rustling of the satin dress attracted his attention. He looked at it a few moments, then in his quaint, quiet way remarked, "Whew! Our cat has a long tail tonight." Mrs. Lincoln did not reply. The president added, "Mother, it is my opinion, if some of that tail was nearer the head, it would be in better style." And he glanced at her bare arms and neck. She had a beautiful neck and arm, and low dresses were becoming to her. She turned away with a look of offended dignity, and presently took the president's arm, and both went downstairs to their guests, leaving me alone with a sick boy. The reception was a large and brilliant one, and the rich notes of the marine band in the apartments below came to the sick room in soft, subdued murmurs, like the wild, faint sobbing of far-off spirits. Some of the young people had suggested dancing, but Mr. Lincoln met the suggestion with an emphatic veto. The brilliance of the scene could not dispel the sadness that rested upon the face of Mrs. Lincoln. During the evening, she came upstairs several times and stood by the bedside of the suffering boy. She loved him with a mother's heart, and her anxiety was great. The night passed slowly. Morning came, and Willie was worse. He lingered a few days and died. God called the beautiful spirit home, and the house of joy was turned into the house of mourning. I was worn out with watching, and was not in the room when Willie died, but was immediately sent for. I assisted in washing him and dressing him, and then laid him on the bed when Mr. Lincoln came in. I never saw a man so bowed down with grief. He came to the bed, lifted the cover from the face of his child, gazed at it long and earnestly, murmuring, "My poor boy, he was too good for this earth. God has called him home. I know that he is much better off in heaven, but then we loved him so. It is hard, hard to have him die." Great sobs choked his utterance. He buried his head in his hands, and his tall frame was convulsed with emotion. I stood at the foot of the bed, my eyes full of tears, looking at the man in silent, awe-stricken wonder. His grief unnerved him and made him a weak, passive child. I did not dream that his rugged nature could be so moved. I shall never forget those solemn moments, genius and greatness weeping over love's idol lost. There is a grandeur as well as a simplicity about the picture that will never fade. With me, it is immortal. I really believe that I shall carry it with me across the dark, mysterious river of death. Mrs. Lincoln's grief was inconsolable. The pale face of her dead boy threw her into convulsions. Around him, love's tendrils had been twined, and now that he was dressed for the tomb, it was like tearing the tendrils out of the heart by their roots. Willie, she often said, if spared by Providence, would be the hope and stay of her old age. But Providence had not spared him. The light faded from his eyes, and the death dew had gathered on his brow. In one of her paroxysms of grief, the president kindly bent over his wife, took her by the arm, and gently led her to the window. With a stately, solemn gesture, he pointed to the lunatic asylum. "Mother, do you see that large white building on the hill yonder? Try and control your grief, or it will drive you mad, and we may have to send you there." Mrs. Lincoln was so completely overwhelmed with sorrow that she did not attend the funeral. Willie was laid to rest in the cemetery, and the White House was draped in mourning. Black crepe everywhere met the eye, contrasting strangely with the gay and brilliant colors of a few days before. Party dresses were laid aside, and everyone who crossed the threshold of the presidential mansion spoke in subdued tones when they thought of the sweet boy at rest. Under the sod and the dew. Previous to this, I had lost my son. Leaving Wilberforce, he went to the battlefield with the 3 months' troops and was killed in Missouri, found his grave on the battlefield where the gallant General Lyon fell. It was a sad blow to me, and the kind womanly letter that Mrs. Lincoln wrote to me when she heard of my bereavement was full of golden words of comfort. Nathaniel Parker Willis, the genial poet, now sleeping in his grave, wrote this beautiful sketch of Willie Lincoln after the sad death of the bright-eyed boy. This little fellow had his acquaintances among his father's friends, and I chanced to be one of them. He never failed to seek me out in the crowd, shake hands, and make some pleasant remark, and this, in a boy of 10 years of age, was, to say the least, endearing to a stranger. But he had more than mere affectionateness. His self-possession, aplomb, as the French call it, was extraordinary. I was one day passing the White House when he was outside with a playfellow on the sidewalk. Mr. Seward drove in with Prince Napoleon and two of his suite in the carriage, and, in a mock heroic way, terms of intimacy evidently existing between the boy and the secretary, the official gentleman took off his hat, and the Napoleon did the same, all making the young prince president a ceremonious salute. Not a bit staggered with the homage, Willie drew himself up to his full height, took off his little cap with graceful self-possession, and bowed down formally to the ground like a little ambassador. They drove past, and he went on unconcernedly with his play, the impromptu readiness and good judgment being clearly a part of his nature. His genial and open expression of countenance was none the less ingenuous and fearless for a certain tincture of fun, and it was in this mingling of qualities that he so faithfully resembled his father. With all the splendor that was around this little fellow in his new home, he was so bravely and beautifully himself, and that only. A wild flower transplanted from the prairie to the hothouse, he retained his prairie habits, unalterably pure and simple, till he died. His leading trait seemed to be a fearless and kindly frankness, willing that everything should be as different as it pleased, but resting unmoved in his own conscious single-heartedness. I found I was studying him irresistibly as one of the sweet problems of childhood that the world is blessed with in rare places, and the news of his death, I was absent from Washington on a visit to my own children at the time, came to me like a knell heard unexpectedly at a merrymaking. On the day of the funeral, I went before the hour to take a near farewell look at the dear boy, for they had embalmed him to send home to the West, to sleep under the sod of his own valley, and the coffin lid was to be closed before the service. The family had just taken their leave of him, and the servants and nurses were seeing him for the last time, and with tears and sobs wholly unrestrained, for he was loved like an idol by every one of them. He lay with eyes closed, his brown hair parted as we had known it, pale in the slumber of death, but otherwise unchanged, for he was dressed as if for the evening, and held in one of his hands, crossed upon his breast, a bunch of exquisite flowers, a message coming from his mother while we were looking upon him that those flowers might be preserved for her. She was lying sick in her bed, worn out with grief and overwatching. The funeral was very touching. Of the entertainments in the East Room, the boy had been, for those who now assembled more especially, a most life-giving variation. With his bright face and his apt greetings and replies, he was remembered in every part of that crimson-curtained hall, built only for pleasure, of all the crowds each night, certainly the one least likely to be death's first mark. He was his father's favorite. They were intimates, often seen hand in hand, and there sat the man, with a burden on his brain at which the world marvels, bent now with the load at both heart and brain, staggering under a blow like the taking from him of his child. His men of power sat around him, McClellan, with a moist eye when he bowed to the prayer, as I could see from where I stood, and Chase and Seward, with their austere features at work, and senators and ambassadors and soldiers, all struggling with their tears, great hearts sorrowing with the president as a stricken man and a brother. That God may give him strength for all his burdens is, I am sure, at present, the prayer of a nation. This sketch was very much admired by Mrs. Lincoln. I copy it from the scrapbook in which she pasted it, with many tears, with her own hands. End of chapter. Read by Lorraine Montgomery for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.